ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, I thought tonight particularly would be a really good night to take a look back at what 2025 gave us in terms of technology. What were some of the big stories of the year, from the rise and potentially the bubble of AI, we'll never know, to some of the biggest challenges that were faced by some of those major names, figures and stakeholders in the tech world. And to do it, we've got Peter Mark, software developer and tech commentator from Access Informatics. And Peter, thanks for having a bit of time for Nightlife.
Oh, great to talk to you, Nick.
We got to talk Apple because, you know, it used to be the days, of course, that a new Apple product swept out and people would queue up around the block. I think we're a little more used to the new stuff at the moment. But controversially, rather than the hardware, it seems to be their software that's raised a few eyebrows this time. What is liquid glass and why are people worried about it?
Yeah, the glass look is the third big idea in phone user interfaces that Apple has shipped. The first iPhones, you might remember in 2007, used textures from the real world. The term there is skeuomorphic. So the background of a note looked like a piece of paper. The calendar had leather on it, said to be the leather that Steve Jobs liked from his private jet. The music scroll wheel looked like brushed metal, and actually it used to move as you tilted the phone or the iPod. Now, interestingly, they were all quite retro designs. The icon for the camera app looked like a photo of a camera. It was quite literal. Now, the next big change that also upset people, maybe people just don't like change, was iOS 7 in 2013, which ditched all of that and went to a flat, minimalist look. It used solid colours. The buttons were minimal. They were just thin text without any background. Of course, the big criticism was you didn't know what you could tap, like you didn't know what were active things. The concept was that your content should be front and centre. So if it was your photo, that would fill up the whole screen and the buttons would be just tiny little things near it. And the user interface should be sort of less visible. Application icons stopped looking like photographs of things and they were minimalist designs. Now, users did find this confusing at first, but eventually they got used to it. And in the end, it influenced design across all phones and computer interfaces. Today, actually, if you look at a screenshot of an Android device, it's quite hard to tell, is it Android or iOS? So that, you know, whatever Apple does tends to get copied. But this year, yeah, we got controversially liquid glass, where the user interface, items like buttons, simulate being on a piece of actual curved glass. And whatever is behind that can be seen through the glass with accurate refraction, reflection, and live movement. As you scroll things past a glass button, for example, it distorts. And where things animate, where the buttons come together, they're like droplets of liquid that merge with surface tension. It's a beautiful sort of thing. And they brought it to all of their platforms, phones, tablets, Macs, and even the TV box. And we're still kind of coming to grips with it, but I think it's an interesting new third idea from them.
So why is there a bit of controversy around it, Peter?
I think it's about readability, legibility. If you've got a glass button on top of a rich background like a photo, maybe it's got dark text on it and you might scroll a dark area of the photo behind it, you suddenly can't read the text. And this ability to read what things say is really important. I think they've sort of gone too far in the, you know, here's the big idea and less in thinking about how easy it is to use. Now, the elements are smart. They notice suddenly there's darkness behind instead of light and they'll change the text to change the colour so that it will be contrasting, but there's a bit of a lag. Another criticism is that all of these user interface items have got bigger. Instead of being little compact buttons, they're now big bits of blobs of glass or liquid. So less controls fit on the screen than before. So there were useful buttons. You might have a photo and there'd be an edit and a rotate and a share. Some of those buttons have now gone away because there simply isn't space for them. And they're all hiding behind these little dot, dot, dot buttons. And you have to sort of say, well, I can't see what I want to do. I'll click on the dot, dot, dot and see what that, you know, shows me. What's worse, I think, on Mac OS is that everything has big round corners. There are some design criticisms too that the corners aren't all the same. The curve varies from window to window. So it wastes space. It also cuts off the corners of images, which are generally rectangular. My guess, Nick, is that Apple is preparing the way for a future touchscreen laptop where, of course, you know, things need to be bigger so your finger can touch on them. I'm a real skeptic about touchscreen laptops. I think it's a bad idea. You get fingerprints all over them. The first version of iOS 26 was pretty rough for all of the, they've renamed all of the operating systems 26. But now 26.2, if you've been holding back, I think it's working really well. And look, I actually have come to like it, although there have been these critics.
It'd be very interesting if they do go the way of that touchscreen laptop after we saw Windows Surface, the idea that it was an entirely touch interface laptop, didn't exactly set the world on fire, did it?
Well, it was very clever. The Windows, what they did was you could have a similar interface. You could sort of switch into touch mode. I think what happened was if you unplugged the keyboard, it would suddenly go into tablet mode. It was a clever idea. I've used touchscreen laptops and I don't like, A, getting my finger on the screen, but secondly, you're pushing on the screen, you know, you're pushing it back, and I just find I'm so used to a mouse. But look, the new generation who've grown up with tablets and things, they're fully on board with touch, and, you know, maybe they'll prefer it. Look, Apple's design choices in the past have influenced the industry. They've shared, you know, everywhere. So I'm not so sure about the glass one. I think one reason why they've done it is Apple's Vice President of Human Interface Design, Alan Dye, might have taken them down this track because, A, they could do it. They had the graphics processing ability in the devices. But also, it's a way of differentiating first-party iPhone applications from cross-platform apps. If you've ever used the Google apps on an iPhone, they look really out of place. And with this glassy user interface everywhere, they're going to even look more alien. So it's kind of a way, I think, of differentiating Apple.
Do you think they want to push that those third-party or other-party apps look more like them, or do you think it's that very much Apple wanting a completely closed ecosystem, you don't need any other products?
I think what they want to stop is the things like ways of developing software that makes it work on Android, on Windows, on Mac, on Linux, and also on an iPhone. But they never look native. They never feel native. The way they scroll isn't right and everything. I think what Apple wants is for people to use their tools, their first-party tools like SwiftUI, which are excellent, but it means you've got to have developers who know about the platform and develop, and that gives you a better quality product, I think. So that's what they're doing. But I think what they're trying to do also is make it obvious that you're using something that isn't in love with their platform, if you like.
You mentioned Alan Dye, the VP of Human Interface Design. Yeah. Is this going to be his legacy?
It seems not, Nick.
Okay.
He came from a magazine design background, I believe. He was one of the people who worked on Wired, which I think you might remember. Wired magazine, we used to call it Weird. Sometimes it's completely unreadable. It was in all big colours and graphics and huge fonts and things, and it kind of explains things a little bit. But look, he announced in early December that he's leaving Apple. He's moving to Meta, the parent of Facebook, actually from tomorrow, and he'll be chief design officer at Meta, and he'll be working on their efforts to break into consumer hardware. It has been quipped that both companies have gotten better following the move. Staff at Apple are rumored to be overjoyed. So I think he, you know, as well as getting criticism out there, he made people a bit uncomfortable. But look, Nick, the departure of the vice president of design is not the only senior management change at Apple.
Interesting.
There's quite a few. John Giandrea, who was a real poach from Google, was the head of AI. Now, he's going to Meta as well. General Counsel Kate Adams is retiring. Vice President of Environment Lisa Jackson is retiring, and she's interestingly not being replaced, which might be due to the anti-environment action culture in the US at the moment. Johnny Cerugi, who's the head of hardware technology, has been knocking it out of the park, you know, in terms of Apple Silicon. He reportedly considered leaving but has since said he's staying. And look, finally, we're all watching for the retirement of CEO Tim Cook. Cook is now 65 and is arguably one of the most effective CEOs of any global company. He took Apple to being a $3 trillion company, at times the most valuable company in the world at the time. That's not anymore. And it might be that all of these executive changes we're seeing are in preparation for a CEO transition. There are a few contenders.
Okay, I was going to ask if there was a clear pathway or a clear succession line.
Yeah, there's John Turnus, who's in charge of hardware. He's done a great job. Craig Federighi, he's head of software. Jeff Williams is another chief operating officer, which is what Cook was, and that's been a very effective way to be CEO. But having said that, many of his contemporaries are of similar age, so it might be time for a generational change in leadership at Apple.
There'll be some challenges there. I mean, I think if you look at, I guess, where they've been pushing AI offerings, it doesn't seem to be in line with what many other companies are doing.
Yeah, they've been a bit slow to adopt, and often they are quite careful about things. And Siri, of course, is the agent that you talk to on Apple platforms, and it's widely regarded as being way behind competitors. If you talk to ChatGPT or Google Gemini or any of these, they're much smarter than Siri is. And that might be why John Giandrea, he basically failed at upgrading at Siri. I don't know why exactly. There were all sorts of stories. But look, it's a tough time, I think, to be the head of a major corporation. Dealing with the Trump administration must be an absolute nightmare. Cook has personally donated to Trump's inauguration and, I believe, to the new wing in the White House. He's also given gifts to Trump. Some might call them bribes. And these moves, I would think, for a presumably progressive Tim Cook, must be galling. But he has saved Apple from some of the worst of the tariffs, which are affecting other businesses in the US. So Apple's doing really well. Some of their monopolistic tendencies have been reined in by legislation in Europe, but the Mac continues to grow market share against other competitors like, obviously, Microsoft Windows.
Peter Marks, just while we're still talking AI, I do want to dive in on this because it has been, I mean, absolutely the tech story that's dominated this year. We have seen so much investment in AI by tech giants, and there's a bit of concern we may be moving towards a bubble. People keep pointing back to, and I was working in the dot-com space back in 99 and 2000 when the bubble was bursting.
You remember that bubble?
I remember that bubble very well. And I know NVIDIA particularly, I mean, $4.6 trillion is their market capitalization. That's more than most countries. I mean, where do we find ourselves? Why are they that valuable genuinely?
It's hard to understand it. At one point, they hit $5 trillion.
What?
It's on the back of tech companies buying their AI boards. Now, I'm not sure how you compare that value with other things in the real world, but the point has been made that they're larger than the GDP of nearly every country. They're worth more than entire national stock markets. So, look, it's clear that the tech giants, you know, all of the companies we've mentioned, and all of the new AI startups are hungry to build out the data centers they expect to need, both to train new models and to then support the AI features. One chunk, of course, of NVIDIA's value is through a $100 billion US cross investment from OpenAI, who make ChatGPT. And as part of that, they've said, well, we're going to buy part of NVIDIA, but we also guarantee to buy NVIDIA's products to fill up their new data centers. So people sort of see this as this kind of loopy, I don't know what you call it in financial terms. It's some sort of loop, and it does seem a bit sus. But look, is it a bubble? Well, certainly the numbers are huge. And as you say, I also lived through the dot-com bubble in 2000. There was an overvaluation. Everyone thought at the time that this is going to change the world. All the physical shops are going to shut and we're just going to buy everything on the internet. And that didn't happen in the short term, but the value is there now. Bill Gates once observed that we tend to overestimate short-term impact but underestimate long-term effects. And look, Nick, I think AI is the biggest thing to come along since the internet. And while we might see a devaluation of NVIDIA, you know, because there are competitors, of course, everyone's trying to make these chips too, overall, our work, education, entertainment, everything is going to be forever changed by this technology. And we're just at the start of it. 2026 will be fascinating.
But, Peter, are we missing the solid usage case for AI in that case? Because as the average punter who is seeing AI being plonked on their desktop, in their, you know, office software, on their phone, everywhere in between, is I think, struggling to a degree to say, what's this actually doing for me?
Yeah, it's, you know, I guess we've had spelling checkers for a long time and we accept those. And now we have things that say, oh, would you like me to make that PowerPoint presentation for you? So I think we'll kind of get used to it. But yes, some of the software companies like Microsoft are using it as an excuse to charge us more money. The Photoshop, the photo editing software, of course, from Adobe now has AI features for removing things, and they've got an extra tier. So they'll make you pay a bit more to get the AI features than you would have, things you would have done manually. I'm a software developer, and I have to say that is the best use case for large language models. It's so efficient for me now to write code. If I wanted to look up how do I do X, how do I make, I don't know, liquid glass bubbles over my screen, I used to have to go and read the documentation, maybe watch a developer video, find some sample code. Now I just ask Claude or one of the large language models, and they say, oh, here, let me write that for you. And they're really good. So maybe I'm on the bleeding edge of usefulness. On the other hand, you know, even things like a spreadsheet where we used to have to know all the formulas, you can now, in text, in plain English, you can say what you want and it will write a formula for it. These are really useful things. But this stuff is only, 3 years old since ChatGPT came out? This is early days. Think of what the internet was like 3 years in. It was terrible. All of this stuff, it will never be as bad as it is today, and it will only get better.
Bring back Netscape. That's what I'm hearing. No, Peter Monks, this has been absolutely fascinating. I could go all night, but we will leave it there. And thank you so much for having some time for Nightlife.
Great to talk to you, Nick.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.